So we have two expert speakers here this evening. They happen to be husband and wife. But I was just talking to Rabbi Mintz, and he tells me that this is the first time in all these years that they have spoken and lectured that they are speaking sort of as a team, back to back. So and he told me he's a little nervous to follow the previous speaker. So, but I'm sure he'll hold his own. Rabbi Mintz is a native of Washington, D.C., attended Yeshiva University where we first met, got smich at Yeshiva University, got a Ph.D. in Jewish history, and of course the topic of his Ph.D. was Halacha in America, the history of city Eruvin from 1894 to 1962. So he's expert. The Ph.D. dissertation, I believe, is available online. And it's about 400 pages long, so probably the lecture is a little shorter than reading the PhD. He's a professor of history at City College in New York. He's taught at Rutgers, many other places. He served as the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue in Manhattan, and today serves as the rabbi of Kehilat Re'im Ha'uvim in Manhattan, and it's a pleasure to have him and his wife Sharon with us over Shabbat. And Bakasha, Rabbi Mintz.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you, everybody. And this is, I think, the first time that Sharon and I have spoken back to back. I guess the advantage I have is that my topic is completely different than Sharon's topic. And that is, I want to talk about the history of the Toronto Eruv. I want to talk about the history of the Toronto Eruv as a history of a fascinating topic, a topic that, you know, is very much real and relevant to all of you. But at the same time, I want to talk about the history of the Toronto Eruv as representative and reflective of the history of Orthodoxy in North America. We live Orthodoxy in North America, but it's interesting to consider how we got to where we are today. And believe it or not, the history of the Eruv of Toronto is really going to shed some light on where Orthodoxy has come from in North America, and I don't know where it's going, but at least where it is today. If you were to check out the Toronto Eruv website, torontoeruv.org, and you would click the link to history, you would find a history of the Eruv in Toronto. And it tells the story, at least in broad strokes, of the history of the Toronto Eruv. It's actually a copy of an article that appeared in Hamodia, in the Orthodox newspaper Hamodia in 1996. So I'm not going to tell you the story as it appears on the website. That's going to kind of be boring. I'd like to, number one, elaborate on that story. Number two, I'd like to give some context to the history of the Toronto Eruv and the history of Eruv in generally. And then to give some context again, as I said, on the life and culture of Orthodox Jewry in North America. Between 1881 and 1901, the Canadian Jewish population grew from 2,443 to 6,401. So by 1901, there were 16,000 Jews in Canada, mostly immigrants, mostly from Eastern Europe. To give you a sense of what Toronto looked like, in 1881, there were 534 Jews in Toronto. By 1911, there were 18,000 Jews in Toronto. Toronto is a real Jewish community by 1911. And when we talk about Eruvin, it's important to know, so where did the Jews live in Toronto? So in those early years, at the beginning of the 20th century, the Jews lived in St. John's Ward. And that was bounded by Yonge Street, by University Avenue, and by Queen and College Streets. Now that's going to be important to keep in mind in a minute when we talk about the boundaries of the Eruv. But for a second, let's just understand what St. John Ward, was. It was considered in that period to be a term they used then, a slum. A slum meant that there were limited resources, that the people were poor, they lived in subpar conditions. These were largely or mainly immigrants, largely Jewish immigrants. Their business, if they had a business, was the clothing business. But unfortunately for most of them, they didn't own these clothing businesses. They were working for somebody else, and they barely survived. Now, with all their difficulty, of course, they created shuls. The first shul that we know about was a shul called Goel Tzedek. It was founded in 1883. It was a Lithuanian shul. That's going to be important in a minute. It was a large shul. It could seat 1,200 people. And it was actually modeled after a Roman Catholic cathedral. Now, if there's a Litvish shul, you know that there's going to be a reaction. You know that a Glitziana shul is going to open. Because at least in those days, the Glitziana didn't daven with the Litvaks, and the Litvaks didn't daven with the Glitziana. So in 1884, Shomrei Shabbos Minhag Sfard opened in the same neighborhood. By World War I, there are 20 small shuls in Toronto. In this small ward, there are 20 small shuls. Now, there are shuls, but even though today we kind of have the image that most shuls have rabbis, in those days, they didn't have rabbis. Now, that wasn't for political reasons. That was for financial reasons. They just couldn't afford a rabbi, right? If they were limited resources and they barely could eat, so the last thing they were worried about was, you know, was having a rabbi in the shul. But therefore, what would happen was you would have a rabbi, and he would be the rabbi of several shuls at the same time. Now, you have to also know that drushas were not a big deal in those days. So the rabbi didn't speak on Shabbos. They were basically shtiblach. And, you know, the rabbi, I guess, over the course of the month or the year would make the rounds. But since they didn't expect the rabbi to speak except on Shabbos Shuvah and Shabbos Haggadah, so it was easy, so to speak, to be the rabbi of several shuls, and it made it more financially viable because the different shuls could kind of, could join together to pay the rabbi. The first rabbi was the rabbi in Shomrei Shabbos in the Glitziana shul. His name was Rabbi Joseph Weinreb. He was from Romania, and he became the rabbi in 1899. Now again, that's the Glitziana rabbi. So you imagine that what's going to happen is there's going to be a Litvish rabbi very quickly. Well, in 1904, a Rabbi Jacob Gordon, who had studied in Valozhin, the famous yeshiva of Valozhin in Lithuania, he arrived to collect money. You know, that's what they did even then. They would travel from city to city to collect money. So this Rabbi Gordon comes to collect money. You know, you can't have better Lithuanian yichus than having studied at the Valozhin yeshiva. So he came to collect money, and what did they do? Instead of giving him a donation, they offered to make him the Lithuanian rabbi. And so in 1904, Rabbi Jacob Gordon becomes the first Lithuanian rabbi in Toronto. And again, this just gives you a little bit of sense, right? There's no selection committee of rabbis. There's no board vote of who the rabbi is going to be. A mishulach comes, and he fits the bill. He studied in Valozhin. What better Litvish rabbi can there be? And he's hired as the first Litvish rabbi. I give you that sense because in a minute we're going to talk about rabbis and rabbis disagreeing with one another and rabbis doing important kinds of things. This is something that developed only over time. These early communities, not only in Toronto, in all cities, including New York, these early rabbis were basically symbolic. It was important for these communities to have a rav. The rav, of course, in those days looked like a rav, right? You know, whatever, however you imagine looking like a rav, these guys looked like rabbanim. And that was very important in these shuls. Now, the first rabbi whose name is a little more familiar is a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yiddel Rosenberg. Rabbi Yiddel Rosenberg was a chassid, and he served as the Polish rabbi, the Glitziana rabbi. He called himself Polish in the 1910s. Now, he didn't like Rabbi Gordon, that's not surprising, the Litvak. So he founded the Polish Talmud Torah, which was renamed Eitz Chaim. That was the beginning of Eitz Chaim. In 1919, Rabbi Yiddel Rosenberg moved to Toronto. Now, Rabbi Yiddel Rosenberg became well known during his time in Toronto for a couple of reasons. First of all, he was a proponent in those early decades of the 20th century of the fact that you could turn on lights on Yontif. This is an interesting discussion, not for now, but the rabbi who was a proponent of the position that lights were electricity was based on the prohibition of fire. And just like fire is allowed on Yontif in order to, you know, turn on stoves and things to cook, so too you can turn on lights on Yontif. Now, this over time became, you know, less and less popular in the community. But Rabbi Yiddel Rosenberg, you talk about rabbis who, you know, who took positions that were unpopular, or maybe it was a very popular position, only over time became unpopular. Rabbi Yiddel Rosenberg was known as the rabbi who allowed the use of electricity on Yontif. But when Rabbi Rosenberg moved to Montreal, there was a need for a new Galiciana rabbi in Toronto. Was there really a need? Was there a need because Rabbi Gordon was a Litvisher rabbi? You can come to your own conclusions. You can write your narrative as you want. But they wanted a rabbi. And they invited Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubard to be the rabbi. Now, Rabbi Graubard, who we'll see comes from Poland, and where he comes from will be important in a second, he didn't want to come to Toronto. He thought Toronto was not a place for a nice Polish rabbi to be. And he resisted and he said, no, I'm not coming. In the summer of 1920, that's a year after they offered him the job, he was in London for a Mizrahi conference. And fights broke out that summer between Russia and Poland. And he couldn't return to Poland. So, you know, if you can't go back to Poland, you might as well come to Toronto. So that's how Rabbi Graubard came to Toronto. Rabbi Graubard was born in 1862. His father was a Gera Chassid, and he was a Rav in several Polish towns. After World War I, he was active in Mizrahi, and he was actually editor of the Mizrahi Journal. That's also interesting how these Polish rabbis, these Hasidim, became involved in Mizrahi. But that's also a story for another time. He was perfect for Toronto. Why? Because he had most recently spent a number of years as the rabbi of a place called Staszew. Now, Staszew was a Polish shtetl. And many Torontonians happened to have come from Staszew. So therefore, he was a landsman. You know, in those days, maybe today a little bit, but in those days, being a landsman was very, very important. Just to explain that for a second, right? The idea, you know, you came here as an immigrant. People came without their families. People left, their families and their cultures and their backgrounds back home in Eastern Europe. And they came here, and what made them feel connected was to find a landsman, was to find someone who came from the same place. Also, people, landsmen, took care of one another. The idea of a landsmanschaft, meaning a group of people from the same place who took care of one another, obviously was laid at the foundation of what, you know, early immigrant Judaism was like in North America. So Stashov was a very important piece of the puzzle for Rabbi Graubart. Rabbi Graubart comes here, and he gets involved in kashrus. And it's a very messy business between himself and Rabbi Gordon in terms of the kashrus situation here. But I want to kind of focus on Eruv, you know, and kashrus is, again, there are so many topics for another time, Rabbi Keldman. But he was extremely interested in the situation of Shabbos observance in Toronto. 1920 Toronto. He writes a letter that he calls a Sabbath letter. And he publishes this letter in Yiddish and in English. I'll read it in English. I, Dame Shabbos, appeal to you. I am sufficiently known to you, and my lineage needs no introduction. I am as old as the Jew. I am the crown of Judaism. And he goes on to criticize Jewish employers and Jewish employees who keep the businesses open on Shabbos and either who force other people to work or who themselves work on Shabbos. And he gets very personal. He says, I go to shul every Shabbos, and I watch these people getting called to the Torah for an aliyah, wishing one another a good Shabbos, and then, he says, off to the factory do they go. And in this letter, he actually makes a suggestion that later on, you know, was actually incorporated. He said, why do you need to work on Shabbos? Can't you work longer during the week and be able to take off on Shabbos? So Shabbos observance was the focus of Rabbi Graubart when he came here to Toronto. Again, you come from Eastern Europe, you come from the shtetl in Poland, you come here, people are working on Shabbos. You know, this is what he wanted to address. In 1924, he actually gave 4 lectures in Kensington Market, talking to all those Jews who kept their stores open on Shabbos. So he went during the week to Kensington Market, and he gave 4 drushas about the fact that you have to keep your stores closed on Shabbos. Again, I don't know how successful or unsuccessful he was, but you see that Shabbos observance was something that he was very concerned about. And therefore, we're not surprised to hear that in 1921, Rabbi Graubart became involved in the procedure or the process of building creating, I think a better word, as you'll see in a second, the first Eruv in Toronto. It actually, just by means of background for a second, is the 3rd Eruv in North America. Now there are over 200 Eruvin in North America. 1896, there was an Eruv in St. Louis. 1905, there's an Eruv on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And 1920, 1921, there's an Eruv in Toronto. That in itself is so fascinating that it requires an explanation. And he writes, Rabbi Graubart's Tshuvos have actually been published and are available. They're called Chavolim Bane'imim. And he writes, translation, he says, this is the beginning of his tshuva, I have been requested here in Toronto by God-fearing people to find a way to allow people to carry on Shabbos. Now, I read that introduction because that's interesting. That's very much different than giving lectures, in Kensington Market about Shmirah Shabbos. When he went to Kensington Market, he went out to the people, tell them you have to observe Shabbos. It sounds, at least from the way he wrote the tshuva, that the Eruv wasn't his idea, but that people came to him, observant people, not the people who were working. I guess not, even though he said those people came to shul, but probably not the people who were working in Kensington Market on Shabbos, but Orthodox people, people who wanted to keep Shabbos, they said, we want an Eruv. We need to find a way to carry on Shabbos. Now, Rabbi Graubart goes on, and the tshuva that he writes is about 100 pages long. Just to summarize it in 1 second, the boundaries of the Eruv are as follows. On the east, to the east, it's the Don River and the surrounding hills. To the west, it's the Humber River, and the hills of High Park. To the south, it's Lake Ontario. And to the north, it's telephone poles and wires that run the length of Bloor Street. Now, to me, only the northern border sounds familiar. Telephone poles and wires, that's what I'm familiar with. So I want to just spend a minute trying to understand how do rivers and lakes create an Eruv boundary. So what makes an Eruv boundary? What is an Eruv? An Eruv was a rabbinic institution that turned a public area into a private area. And just like you're allowed to carry in your house or in your backyard, so too, if the public area is surrounded, you'd be allowed to carry in that public area. Initially, the Eruv boundaries were walls or fences. Over time, the Gemara says, it was hard to create, you know, to build these walls and fences. Therefore, they allowed for symbolic walls. A pole and a string and another pole, that created a wall, at least regarding the laws of Eruv. Now, that explains why telephone poles and wires are acceptable. But what about rivers and lakes? How do they create Eruv boundaries? Where exactly is the wall? So the answer is that rivers and lakes don't automatically create Eruv boundaries. Actually, the river and the lake only creates an Eruv boundary, says the Gemara, if there's a sea wall, if there's a place where the river or the lake actually descends quickly so that it creates a wall. To put it in terms we can understand, a beach would not be considered an Eruv boundary, but where there would be a port or there would be an end to the river or to the lake, that would create an Eruv boundary. And Rabbi Graubart goes on in great detail to explain how he's checked the rivers and Lake Ontario and that they are not beaches. Rather, they are rivers and lakes. The Eruv wall is an acceptable Eruv wall. Now, what about telephone poles and wires? So this needs just a little bit of explanation about how Eruv works. And you'll see why it's interesting in the story of Toronto. Generally speaking, the Gemara says, this all goes back to the Gemara. Generally speaking, the Gemara says, to make a symbolic wall, the string or the wire needs to be on top of the pole. It can't be wrapped around the pole. It has to be on top of the pole. So you need to, you know, to wrap the wire or the string around something, you know, a nail or something on the top of the pole, and then connect it to the next pole. The problem with telephone poles is, obviously, the telephone pole is on top, but you know what a telephone pole looks like. The wires don't run on the top of the pole. They run on the side of the pole. Now, the problem is, how can that count as an Eruv boundary? Well, the other side of it is how it needs to count as an Eruv boundary. Because if the northern boundary is going to be on Bloor Street, and there's no river or lake on Bloor Street, so therefore, you know, we need to find an Eruv boundary. So Rabbi Graubart says that in the case of the telephone poles in Toronto, there was a crossbar that came out of the telephone pole, and actually the wires were on top of the crossbar. Since the wires were on top of the crossbar, so they were, so therefore the wire was on top, not on the side. And he says that a similar question had come up in Warsaw. And he actually sent a picture of the telephone poles in Toronto to the rabbi in Warsaw. And the rabbi in Warsaw told him, this is good, this is just like the telephone poles in Warsaw, and therefore it's acceptable. Just think for a minute about 1921 and telephone poles in Warsaw and telephone poles in Toronto. And, you know, they're sending pictures back and forth and they're paskening about carrying on Shabbos based on these pictures. It's amazing to think of what, you know, how much has changed in 100 years. But, and here's the most interesting but. Rabbi Graubard, just to be sure, added small little poles next to the telephone poles across Bloor Street. Not at every telephone pole, but at a few telephone poles across the way, he added little poles, little sticks that he connected to the telephone poles. Because the Gemara says that if you have a little pole that's 10 tefachim, that's 35 inches high, that even though the string or the wire is not directly on top of it, but since it's on top of it, even though it's not connected, then it's definitely would be an acceptable Eruv boundary. Now, why is that interesting? Because they did the same thing in Warsaw. They also put up these little poles. But when they put up these little poles in Warsaw, the rabbi said, quote, the Jews had to be careful that the poles remained inconspicuous. What were they worried about in Warsaw? They didn't want to get in trouble with the local authorities. Who are you to put up poles? Who are you to put up little poles next to our telephone poles? So they said in Warsaw they did it, but they somehow made sure that they remained inconspicuous. What's interesting is the Rabbi Graubard doesn't seem to be worried about that. It doesn't say anywhere that he was concerned about making them inconspicuous. And that shows you something, you know, that we take for granted, but in 1921 was not to be taken for granted. And that's the fact that today, today Eruvin are made with an agreement with the local authorities, and there was a city councilman here this afternoon. I talked to him about how the Eruv today is made in Toronto, the same way it's made in New York, in every community. And that is, there's an agreement with the local city council or the local mayor or the governor, whoever it happens to be, to allow them, you know, to construct the Eruv as they need to construct the Eruv. But in 1920, the Jews didn't have that kind of relationship with the local government. And they didn't feel comfortable going and saying, by the way, would you mind if we put little poles up, you know, across Bloor Street? They'd be thrown out. What a crazy request to make. So the question is, you know, how far could they push, you know, for their needs without getting the authorities upset with them? And therefore, the fact that Rabbi Graubard doesn't say we need to make them inconspicuous, or we can't do it because we can't ask permission, and therefore, how are we gonna put up these poles? You see that at least a little bit, Rabbi Graubard felt comfortable enough to put up these poles and wasn't afraid that, so to speak, he was going to get in trouble. Just to compare this for a moment, I told you that the first Eruv in North America was created in 1896 in St. Louis. The four boundaries of the Eruv were all mountains and rivers. Mountains are the same thing as being a wall, right? Mountains and river, they were all natural boundaries. 1905, the Eruv on the Lower East Side was boundaries, the rivers around Manhattan. And the western boundary of the Eruv was the 3rd Avenue elevated train, the elevated train tracks. You know, in New York, there used to be elevated train tracks. Now there, the train tracks run on top of the poles, right, of the poles that hold up the train tracks. So there was no problem. Now, why do I tell you that? Because in the two previous Eruvin in North America, And in all the Aravin in Eastern Europe, the Jews needed to rely on either natural boundaries or man-made boundaries, that were there already, that they didn't have to touch, because they didn't feel comfortable as Jews, as immigrant Jews in North America at the time, to ask permission or, you know, to ask permission from the authorities or to do something that they didn't have permission for. And therefore, the fact that Rabbi Graubard was willing even just to put up these little poles a couple of places along the way was really a big move in the history of Eruvin, as we'll see in a second. Now, the next, so here you go. Here we have an Eruv. I don't have anyone saying that they carried in the Eruv, and I don't have anybody saying that they didn't carry in the Eruv, but I do know that there was no written opposition to the Eruv in Toronto. Now, you say, why should there be opposition? You say, well, there's always opposition to everything, and especially in Eruvin. Well, the idea that there's opposition to Eruvin is not something that came up in the 21st century. In the two previous Eruvin in St. Louis in New York, there was tremendous opposition. In St. Louis, the Eruv was built by one rabbi. The rabbi down the street said that basically anybody who carries in the other rabbi's Eruv is not going to get an aliyah in my shul. And he said the Eruv is no good, and he didn't like the whole idea of Eruvin. In New York as well, the Eruv was built by a Hasidish Rebbe, Rabbi Yehoshua Siegel. The Litvaks said that the Eruv was no good. Just 1 second on that. Generally, Hasidim are more pro-Eruv than Litvaks. Why is that? Why is that, everybody? Because Eruvin is a very tricky business. You know, to make an Eruv in a modern city that's going to match the description in the Gemara, you know, there's a lot of reason to say that a modern city, you cannot have an Eruv in a modern city the way they had an Eruv in the time of the Gemara. The Hasidim, though, were more prone to the idea of enjoying Shabbos, and therefore their view of Eruvin was to be more permissive. Now, that's not totally a fair thing to say, because I don't want to give you the impression that the Hasidim and the Glitziana Rabbanim allowed Eruvin that weren't kosher. But generally, their attitude towards Eruvin was a lot more, was a lot more permissive. So, if that's so, the question is, why was there no opposition in Toronto? Right? We said there were Litvaks, there were Glitziana. They didn't like each other. They didn't daven each other's shul. This is the perfect thing to argue about, which is the Eruv. So one possibility is that Rabbi Graubard was accepted, even by the Litvaks. They appreciated the fact that he was a Talmud Chacham. I don't buy that, because that's never good enough, right? The other is that maybe by that time the Lithuanian community was weaker, the Polish community was stronger, and therefore they weren't in a position to be outspoken. But what's more interesting is that if you look at the newspapers, the Jewish Yiddish newspapers in Toronto from those years, the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, there is no mention of the Toronto Eruv. Not pro and not against. There's no mention of the Toronto Eruv. And it seems to be that Rabbi Graubard made the Eruv very quietly. And that's also, whether he did it intentionally or not, I'm not sure. But it was quiet. It wasn't an issue. And because it wasn't an issue, it kind of slid under the radar. And the people who wanted to carry, carried. The people who didn't want to carry, did not carry. The Rabbi Graubard went in 1929. He moved to St. Louis. Then he didn't like St. Louis. He liked Toronto. So he came back to Toronto. And he died in 1937 here in Toronto. And the Eruv continued. But of course, the Jews move north. And therefore, there's a need to extend the Eruv. In December of 1950, Rabbi Avraham Price writes an article in the rabbinic journal Hapardes outlining an extension to the Toronto Eruv. Rabbi Price was a Talmud of the Avnei Nezer. He was a respected rabbinic leader who came from Poland. He arrives in Toronto in 1937. He's the dean of Toras Chaim and the rabbi of the Polish shul Chevrah Shas. And he is the respected Talmud Chacham and rabbinic leader of Toronto during that period, during the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. And he writes an article outlining the extension of the Eruv. We know that after the Second World War, that was the period of suburbanization in North America, right? Levittown. People coming back from the war, Jews included, maybe mainly Jews, tended to move to the suburbs. The Jewish community in Toronto grows in 1921. In 1921, there are 34,000 Jews. By 1951, there are 66,000 Jews. Now, Rabbi Price writes that the only change in the Eruv is the northern border, because the other borders are fine. It's just that the Jews are moving north. So it moves from Bloor Street to Wilson Street. But here's the kicker. And he says the only improvement he wants to make over Rabbi Graubard's Eruv is that Rabbi Graubard put these small poles up every couple of telephone poles. Rabbi Price thinks that these small poles should go up at every telephone pole. To me as a historian, that's interesting, not for halakhic reasons. Rabbi Graubard has a good reason to only put them up every several. Rabbi Price puts them up at every telephone pole. You know why? Because he feels confident that he can. Right? This was the big deal. Those little poles on the telephone pole, that was the, you know, that was kind of the Orthodox rabbinate kind of, you know, taking a chance, taking a risk. Can we get away with this? Rabbi Graubard did it, but he did it only every couple of poles. Obviously, Rabbi Price sees Rabbi Graubard did it every couple of poles, so he didn't get in trouble. Rabbi Price, again, is the next generation, feels more comfortable, so he puts it up every pole. And therefore, what we see here is, in its own little way, that the Jews are becoming more comfortable in Toronto, in North America. And that's really, and obviously, well, I'm going to draw on this as we continue, but that idea of immigrants who begin very much on the margins of society, immigrants who come, who don't speak the language, even when they learn the language, they have accents, they don't feel comfortable. The culture is never their culture. But as the Jews become more familiar, more acculturated, as the next generation comes, the generation that looks North American, that speaks North American, speaks English, and is familiar with the culture, they feel more confident. They may still not feel confident enough to go to the authorities to ask permission to put up these poles, but they just feel more at home. And that's what we see in this move from Rabbi Graubard's occasional pole to Rabbi Price's pole every telephone pole. And now we come to the opposition to the Toronto Eruv. In 1987, Rabbi Jacob Sofer, who was a rabbi who was brought by the Reichman family, said that anyone who relied on Rabbi Price's Eruv was a Mechalel Shabbos Bifarhesia. They were a Shabbos violator. Now, as you can imagine, there were statements written back and forth. There were Pashkevilin, means there were signs put up in the different neighborhoods. And this became very fierce and very unpleasant. And then, Rabbi Price, in 1987, writes an unpublished, and someone said to me before that this is now going to be published, but until today, it has not been published, a 27-typewritten defense of the Eruv. And basically, he goes through 26 pages. He goes through the halacha of the Eruv, explaining why what he does is perfect. At the end, he talks to the machmirim, the people who are being strict about the Eruv. And he makes 2 points. Number one, he says that the tradition is to be lenient when it comes to the laws of Eruv. That's the first thing. He says, by being machmir, by pointing out all the stringencies, not only are you wrong, but the tradition is not to do that. You're supposed to be lenient. Like I said, that was his tradition, that you're supposed to be lenient when it comes to Eruv because you want people to enjoy Shabbos. And then he writes in the last sentence. This is a translation, but it's even better in Hebrew. Anyone with a brain in his head will see that the Eruv I built in Toronto is better than any Eruv I have seen anywhere in the world. Now, what happens? You say, you're not supposed to be strict when it comes to Eruv. But over time, they decided to be strict. And therefore, a new Eruv was constructed under the auspices of Rabbi Shlomo Miller and the Kollel. But here's the interesting thing. It was erected in 1995. Rabbi Price died in 1994. So while it was not stated explicitly, it seems clear that everyone respected Rabbi Price enough so that the new Eruv was not constructed until after he died. Now, the new Eruv is very much a neighborhood Eruv, like in all the suburban neighborhoods in America. It's basically an Eruv that is built from poles and wires and strings, and it's a traditional kind of late 20th century, early 21st century Eruv. However, there is still a however, and that is that Ramosha Feinstein was asked in 1959. In the 1950s, several Rabbonim who had survived the Holocaust came to New York, and they decided what they wanted to do for the good of Jews after the Holocaust was they wanted to create an Eruv in Manhattan. And they basically showed how, since Manhattan is an island, that therefore it's enclosed by the rivers, and that those rivers were counted as an Eruv. And the one who was the proponent who wrote about this was Rabbi Mendel Kasher, and he has written about this, there's a long tshuva about this. Ramosha Feinstein was opposed to this Eruv. And basically, the opposition of Ramosha Feinstein to this Eruv was, you just can't make an Eruv in such a large city. It just doesn't work. Meaning that the Gemara says that a city that has more than 600,000 people cannot be enclosed to be an Eruv. Now, this was not a problem. New York was not the first place this was a problem. This was a problem in Krakow in 1900 when they wanted to build an Eruv there. This was a problem in Odessa in 1901 when they wanted to build an Eruv there. This was a problem in Warsaw in the 1920s. This issue had been addressed already in Poland and Eastern Europe. And each of the Rabbonim in Eastern Europe had come up some way with figuring out how, Even though it looked like there were 600,000 people, there weren't really 600,000 people. So maybe the people in cars didn't count. And maybe there had to be 600,000 people at the same time. And maybe it had to be 600,000 people not in the city, but in one area of the city. Anyway, they allowed it in these cities. But Ramosha Feinstein said that in Manhattan, you could not build an Eruv. Manhattan was too big to build an Eruv. This came up again in New York when they tried to build a Brooklyn Eruv in the 1970s. And Ramosha Feinstein has several tshuvos against a Brooklyn Eruv. Now, Toronto has many more than 600,000 people. So how can you build an Eruv around Toronto? So they're stuck, means they can build all the fancy Eruvim they want, but Moshe Feinstein says you can't have an Eruv. So they went to Rebbe Yashiv. So this is the 1990s. Moshe Feinstein is no longer alive. Rebbe Yashiv is the posek. He's not the American posek, but he was the posek in Yerushalayim. And Rebbe Yashiv said something that's so wonderful. He told them that Moshe Feinstein is right. However, Toronto is grandfathered in. Since Toronto had an Eruv all the way back in 1921, and Rabbi Price extended the Eruv in 1950, and both of those Eruvim were around before Ramosha wrote his tshuva, so therefore the Eruv in Toronto is grandfathered in. Why do I like that so much? Because that's not, I don't know what kind of argument that is. That's kind of, you know, that's just a wonderful argument, which says it's like he's a historian, not a posek. He says, you know, you've always had an Eruv. Don't tell me now in 1995 the Eruv is no good. The Eruv's always been good, and therefore the Eruv will always continue to be good. And it's based on that psak of Rebbe Yashiv, and you can see it, all this is discussed on the website. Based on that psak, Rebbe Yashiv, there not only is an Eruv in Toronto, but more or less the Eruv is accepted in Toronto. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm pointing out about Rebbe Yashiv. It's not a psak, it's kind of a history lesson, right? What do you mean? They probably wouldn't think Rabbi Graubart's Eruv was good either, but he was long gone by the time the Kollel came here. So they only attacked Rabbi Price, not Rabbi Graubart. Okay. Now, finally, the question is, what happened in the 1980s? You know, right, that we said that the Eruv in Toronto, there was no opposition. Rabbi Graubart built the Eruv, no opposition. Rabbi Price extended the Eruv, there's no opposition. 1987, they wake up, and all of a sudden there's opposition. So, were the rabbis bigger Talmidei Chachamim in 1987 than Rabbi Graubart and Rabbi Price? Doubtful. Were the people more religious? Yeah, probably, but that didn't affect it because people don't know the laws of Eruvin, really. It wasn't about the people. But really, it's about a phenomenon, and with this I want to kind of pull the whole thing together. It's really about a phenomenon that the Orthodox community experiences now and has experienced for the past 30 years that I like to call, we can, therefore we will. You see, Rabbi Graubart and Rabbi Price, they couldn't. They felt they had very little flexibility. Again, immigrant generation, they just didn't have the ability to build an Eruv the way the Kollel would want an Eruv to be built today. Again, even those little small poles were an issue, maybe only in their heads, but they were an issue. But by the 1980s, Jews felt part of the establishment. They felt that they had enough political clout that they could, and therefore they would. And therefore, that we can, therefore we will, not only allowed them to improve the Eruv, but led them to criticize what had been done before. I'll just end with one story, not about Toronto, but a story that kind of brings this to light. And this is a story about one of the first Orthodox communities outside of Manhattan that had an Eruv. And that's the community of Kew Gardens Hills. Kew Gardens Hills in Queens is right next to LaGuardia Airport. And it was a place in the early 1970s where many young Orthodox couples moved. It was close enough to the city that they could easily commute to the city for work, but it was cheaper than the city. But there was no Eruv. And the way the story is told, every Shabbos morning, the young men would go, you know, the young married men with children would go to shul. And of course, their wives would complain to them that they weren't able to go to shul because there was no Eruv. And these two young Orthodox men, seems that one Shabbos they had both kind of had enough of, you know, they were frustrated by the fact that their wives were upset and they thought something needs to happen. And they identified in shul, they were in shul, And they had heard in shul that there was a young lawyer, a young Orthodox lawyer, who worked for the borough president. In those days, the borough president's name was Donald Manus. He worked for the Queens, the borough president of Queens. And these two young Orthodox guys got up the chutzpah. And they went over to this young lawyer at Kiddush. And they said to him the following. They said, we need an Eruv, or our families need an Eruv in Kew Gardens Hills. But we can't, right? There are no rivers around Kew Gardens Hills, 1973. The only way we're going to be able to build an Eruv is if we get permission from the borough president, from the borough president Manus, to be able to put up these strings and the poles and whatever we need to do, right? It's not a big deal. We'll give you the, you know, we basically have mapped out exactly what we need. And we need this, you know, we need permission from the borough president. This young lawyer turns white, and he says, I just got my job. He says, you want me to be fired before I've even worked here for a month? He says, if I go to the borough president and I ask him for permission to put up these strings and poles, he's going to think I'm crazy, and that's going to be the end of me. And they didn't stop. Obviously, they didn't get their way that Shabbos, but it seems to be that, you know, enough kiddushes, and they convinced him. He says, you know, I guess like Esther Amalka, v'chasher avadati, avadati. He says, whatever will be, and he does it. And he describes how he went to, he made an appointment to see the borough president. And he sits down, and he literally is too scared to talk. And the borough president looks at him and says, what is the problem? Like, what are you so afraid of? And he said, listen, he says, I have a request to make from you. He says, I don't know what you're going to think of this request, but I'm making it on behalf of the Orthodox community in Kew Gardens Hills. And he outlines it, and he shows him the map. And Donald Manus, with the biggest smile on his face, said, whatever you need. And that is the beginning of the Eruv in Kew Gardens Hills. Actually, once they got Donald Manus to say whatever you need, then they brought Ramosha Feinstein and they drove him around Kew Gardens Hills. Once, whatever you need, you might as well get Ramosha Feinstein to say it's okay. And that Eruv is actually the only Eruv ever that has the personal hashgacha of Ramosha Feinstein. Why is that story interesting? Because whether the other stories of other communities, whether it's in Toronto or whether it's in the United States or any of the other places, they may not be quite as dramatic as this poor young lawyer at Kiddush being convinced to go to the borough president, but every community is the same. And that is that the story of the history of Eruvin, where it starts where there are 1, 2, 3 Eruvin in the United States before 1950, and now there are over 200 Eruvin in North America. There are even Eruvin in Europe. Vienna has an Eruv, and there's a whole Eruv website, and some of the other cities in Europe have Eruvin. Jews feel that they are in a different place than they, you know, than they were 100 years ago. And it's really the immigrant experience. You know, 100 years later, after the Jews have come here to the United States, or 75 years later, whenever the Jews came, the Jews now are part of the establishment. And as part of the establishment, they have the ability to use those connections and that influence to do really good things for the Jewish community and for the community at large. And I leave you just to say that Jewish power and Jewish influence are wonderful things. But they're also a tremendous responsibility. And let's make sure that we use that responsibility responsibly. Thank you very much. Questions? Right. Yes, Julie. Oh, that's fantastic. Mazel tov. Any other questions? Okay, we're good. Thank you very much.